From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Ray Kirstein, your host. The Reverend Welton Gaddy has the week off, but we have some important conversations from past shows to share with you. In fact, so much has changed so fast in our country, it's important to revisit these topics in the context in which we find ourselves living. Obviously, immigration is at the very forefront of national political rhetoric right now. We'll revisit several key conversations on the topic. The Public Religion Research Institute has done invaluable work across the years, gauging the pulse of Americans on numerous issues, including immigration and immigrants. Last year, Dr. Robert P. Jones, CEO of PRRI, was with us with details of the newest research. And with increased immigration enforcement in the headlines, right alongside sanctuary cities, we'll rewind to a pair of conversations from 2014 and 2013 with faith leaders whose congregations had prayerfully decided to offer sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. And we'll also get some thoughts from Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline on what's been happening in our national politics during this past week. But first, doesn't it feel like we're living in an Alice through the looking glass version of America? No matter what happens, half of Americans seem to see it in exactly opposite ways from the other half of Americans. The president's press conference was a disaster. It was an unmitigated success. The press is the opposition party, in the tank for Hillary and George Soros, determined to bring down this administration for partisan gain. The press is comprised mostly of idealistic and industrious journalists who worship facts and fear for democracy's very survival in the face of this demented president. Half of us are clear on what we are seeing and just can't understand how the other half doesn't see it, which is exactly what the other half is saying about us. A story that Sikh activist and filmmaker Valerie Kaur told Welton Gaddy on this show. They were talking about her role in the Revolutionary Love Tour happening last October, movingly described the difficulty and the potential rewards of struggling to see ourselves in even people who are the least like us. Seeing Valerie take a leading role in bringing revolutionary love to New York City on Valentine's Day 2017, speaking out in support of threatened immigrant communities, brought that story to mind and made it seem important to start this week's highlight show, surrounded as we are by people who are hard to recognize as fellow Americans, people who would probably say the same thing about us right now, by replaying Valerie's story.
Valerie, how can I love someone that I don't even like?
Dr. King said it best, that love does not require us to like people, mm-hmm. that we don't have to like them in order to love them, that instead we can notice that perhaps the thing is that we don't like about them, the thing is that makes us angry, is some dark piece of our own heart, that we all carry these dark impulses within us. And so to have compassion for that, I think, to see our humanity in others, to see their humanity in ours, to look upon even the faces of people who say horrific things and still call them brother. I'm going to leave you with one more story, Welton, because okay. This just happened a few weeks ago. I was at my neighborhood restaurant writing about revolutionary love. Mm. When there was a group of men sitting at the table next to me, and they said the word sand, N-I-G-G-E-R, repeatedly at the top of their lungs. And here I am writing about how we must express love even for those who we disagree with. Mm. Like, oh, no, I have to do something now. And so I felt the pain in my body. You know, I felt the chill down my spine. And then I closed my eyes, and I said my grandfather's prayer, because that's my second step. I go to the love. And then I could breathe and bring myself to my feet, and I went to them and I said, people have used that word while harming, while beating, while killing people in my family and in my community. And we talked for almost an hour. Hmm. And they were hardened. They were defensive and they were hardened. But the moment I said, if I had heard what you said and said, oh, that's just a table of bigots, then I would have never come over. Hmm. But I heard what you said and I said, oh, that's the table of my uncles are sitting at that table. My uncles are at that table, so I need to come to them as their niece and tell them about the pain that their words are causing. And as soon as I asked them to look at me, not as a stranger or as an adversary, but as a sister, as a niece, mm-hmm. everything changed. Hmm. Everything softened. And I think that's the key. People who hurt us, people who disagree with us, can we still look upon their faces and say, brother, sister? Guru Nanak says, I see no stranger. I see no enemy. If we change the way we see, if we see through the lens of love, then how might that change the way that we act?
That's Valerie Carr, award-winning filmmaker, civil rights lawyer, media commentator, Sikh activist, and interfaith leader, speaking with Welton Gaddy on this show last October. We have to take a break, but there's lots more still to come on this week's Best Of Show. We'll examine immigration issues from two perspectives: public opinion, as identified by the Public Religion Research Institute, and faith communities offering sanctuary to threatened undocumented immigrants, even before the current crisis level of fear for many such families in this country. And later, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline will be here with some thoughts on today's political situation. You're listening to the Best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Dr. Robert P. Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, has been on the show numerous times to explore the periodic surveys he's conducted on American views toward immigrants and immigration. Here's an excerpt of the most recent such report from April of 2016.
This data is based on the enormous PRRI American Values Atlas. Remind our listeners, if you will, of the sample size we're talking about and what you were looking to find out with this new report.
This is a fairly unusual project. I mean, you know, your typical public opinion polls you might see in the new, you know, cover the news is about 1,000 Americans. And this recent report is based on a data set that's roughly 40 times larger than that. So we interviewed 42,000 Americans between May 2015 and January 2016 to really ask their beliefs and attitudes about how do they perceive immigrants and what do they think we ought to do about the roughly 11 million immigrants currently living in the country illegally.
So what are the most notable findings in this survey?
Well, I think the most notable thing is that this survey is a reminder that the most heated rhetoric that we've heard around, particularly around the Republican primary campaign, has really been around, you know, building a wall, prohibiting, you know, Muslims from entering the country. It's very kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that we've heard from the Republican side of politics. And it's a good reminder that that really is not where the dial is set for most Americans. So when we ask Americans, for example, like how they perceive immigrants, are they a threat to the country, or do the growing number of newcomers strengthen American society? Mm-hmm. We find about half of Americans say that immigrants strengthen the country, and about a little more than a third say they represent a threat to the country.
You know, I never have asked you about one of these polling initiatives, but are people pretty willing to talk about what you want them to talk about?
Well, you know, we try to ask the questions in a way that will allow people to answer the questions no matter, you know, what their views are on the topic. So I think that's really key, is kind of asking kind of nice, balanced questions that don't put people back on their heels no matter what their opinions are. You know, and generally speaking, certainly the polling industry is kind of at this transition. But, you know, when we do a really good telephone poll, we are still able to get, you know, it's about a 10% response rate, which is down. But still, all of our measures show that, you know, polling, despite the fact that response rates are falling, is still a pretty accurate way of understanding public opinion.
Yeah. I just was interested in that because I have coffee a lot of mornings in different places here in town in Monroe, and I can't tell you how smart these people are. Every one of them has an impression about this subject. I'm interested in how demographics, particularly religious affiliation, plays into all of this. Are there groups that stand out in terms of the people you surveyed as well as in terms of the way different groups of immigrants are perceived based on their faith traditions?
What we find is that there is a divide in the religious community, and not surprisingly, we find religious groups that are themselves made up of groups of, you know, recent immigrants like Hindus and Muslims, Latino Protestants, Latino Catholics, tend to have more positive views of immigrants. In fact, the majorities of them say that, that newcomers to society strengthen America. On the other hand, we tend to see that sort of white Christian groups tend to be more negative. So fewer than half of Mormons, fewer than half even of white mainline Protestants, white Catholics say immigrants strengthen the country. But having said all that, there's really one group that stands out more than any other, and that is white evangelical Protestants, as the only religious community where a majority believe that immigrants threaten traditional American customs and values, and only about a third say that newcomers benefit the society. But they really do stick out as a kind of group with a different view than every other religious group in the country.
That's really strange, because that is the group of Christians in the country that you think would be most literalistic in understanding Scripture and conservative in how to follow Jesus. And the Bible is full of material about welcoming the stranger and offering hospitality in the name of faith. Would you reflect on that just for a second?
So one thing that we found in public opinion polling, we actually have asked in the past about this theme of welcoming the stranger, and by and large, that phrase has not a lot of power with most groups in the country. The one group that it does have some leverage over is this group, white evangelical Protestants, but I think what's working at odds with that is that they are also a heavily Republican constituency, and it's important to remember when you're talking about groups, and you know, even if we're primarily describing them as divided by religion, these are everyday people that have political identities. They're of a certain gender. They're certain geographic areas. So they live in the South. They're still predominantly South and Midwest. White evangelicals are, which is a more conservative area of the country. They are heavily Republican, tend to vote about 8 in 10 for Republican candidates. And Republicans have been very tough on this issue. The leading Republican candidates, at least, have drawn a really hard line on immigration. And I think you see that reflected here in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. What did you find most surprising about what you learned?
Well, even though Americans are kind of more divided about what they think about immigrants themselves, particularly newer immigrants, there's a partisan divide there, as we just talked about. There's a religion divide, with white evangelicals being more negative about immigrants. There is a virtual consensus on policy, and that's really surprising. It's surprising given the divisions on perceptions of immigrants. It's also, I think, surprising just given the political polarization in the country in general. But 62% of Americans say, when it comes to policy, what should we do with the approximately 11 million immigrants who are living in the country illegally? More than 6 in 10 say that they should be allowed a way to become citizens provided they meet certain requirements. Another 15% say they should be allowed to stay but be permanent legal residents and not citizens. And only 1 in 5 say that illegal immigrants should be identified and deported. There is bipartisan agreement on this. Even a slim majority of Republicans favor a path to citizenship for immigrants living in the country illegally. Every religious group, including white evangelical Protestants, who have more reservations about the impact of immigrants, support this policy. It's just quite remarkable. And yet, it's a policy that has been political football, has really stalled out in Congress, and just can't seem to get across the finish line.
So would you agree with me, if I'm hearing you correctly, that the results of this poll are actually rather encouraging?
You know, on the question of immigration reform, you know, I'd say it's encouraging anytime we can find, you know, a basic policy that's a major policy. You know, over a it's not a small issue or a small problem that it deals with. It's a big problem. It's a prominent issue, and it is quite remarkable that there's this kind of consensus about what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. What results did you find alarming?
One of the great things about this survey, because we had 42,000 interviews, it allowed us to actually get a statistically significant portrait of every single state in the country. What we basically see is the states that have a longer experience dealing with immigrants, so that is New York, Massachusetts, California, the places that have been historic reception points for immigrants for more than 100 years now, those states all tend to have more positive views of immigrants than states that actually have less experience dealing with immigrants and even lower levels of immigrants in the present. So it's this kind of interesting pattern of states in the Midwest, the Deep South, and then this upward swing of states through Appalachia that have the most negative views of immigrants and the most worried about this. But they're also the states that have actually had to deal with this problem less. And I think there may be a lesson to be learned there that, like, once states have actually dealt with these issues, they've actually had a pretty positive experience. And it really is the states for whom this is a new issue that I think the fears are the greatest.
You know, I'm going to ask you right now to give your website information to listeners because they may want to go see that for themselves.
Yeah, so you can see it two places. If you want to see our analysis, you can just go to our homepage. It's publicreligion.org. And we also have an interactive map where your listeners can actually play around with the data. You can click on different states, see what the different attitudes are. And that address is ava.publicreligion.org. That AVA is for American Values Atlas.
Now, I want to change the subject for just a minute. You, Robbie, were on CNN recently talking about evangelical voters and the appeal of Donald Trump. Are there insights that you'd be willing to share with our listeners, many of whom are watching this election cycle and honestly just shaking their heads?
Well, you know, Welton, I think that, you know, I, like many other people who, you know, are trying to kind of understand the lay of the land, are just like, you know, the people you're describing, have all been scratching our heads, shaking our heads, trying to figure out what's going on here. You know, there's been a lot of theories spun out, but I mean, I think my best take on it is I wrote a piece in The Atlantic a few weeks ago kind of trying to describe this, and what I concluded was that the kind of so-called values voters that were so talked about around 2004, around George W. Bush's reelection and afterward, I would say that one of the things that Trump has revealed to us is that values voters have really become what I'm calling nostalgia voters, and that this goes a long way toward explaining how white evangelical Protestants, for example, can vote for a candidate who's been divorced twice, who owns casinos, who curses during campaign speeches, and is prone to, you know, clearly demonstrates that he's unfamiliar with church culture by doing things like putting cash into the communion plate, mistakenly thinking it's the offering plate, you know, talking about 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. I mean, you know, I could go on and on. Clearly not, you know, the typical conservative Christian or Christian right candidate. And yet, when we look at Super Tuesday, which are all the southern states, pretty much, he pretty much swept, you know, ran the table there. And one question that I think casts some light on this, we asked a question about just changes in American culture, and the question says, since the 1950s, has American culture and way of life mostly changed for the better or changed for the worse? And one of the things that we noticed about white evangelical Protestant voters is that, you know, while all Americans are kind of divided on this question, 72% of white evangelical Protestants say that American culture has changed for the worst since the 1950s. And to me, that was kind of a clue. If we put that together with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, and especially with the emphasis on that last word, I think one of the things going on is that white evangelicals are really feeling their own numbers declining, their cultural influence declining, and Trump is really, I think, promising in many ways to turn the tide of the war, kind of culture war they feel like they're losing, and in many ways turn back the clock.
So how much of an impact do you think the issue of immigration is going to have on the 2016 elections?
Well, it's clearly, if we look at conservative Republicans, right, which are, you know, the most likely people to actually participate in primaries, I think that you can understand they are fairly anti-immigrant. They have big fears about immigration, about immigrants, and you can understand why the candidates are appealing the way they are. I think the real challenge is going to be that, you know, every candidate has to turn from a primary to the general election, if they become the nominee. And the distance between where conservative Republican primary voters are and where the general public is enormous. It's often talked about as a pivot, that candidates have to kind of pivot for a more, you know, liberal or conservative position to the middle as they go to the general election. I don't even think that metaphor of a pivot works. I mean, we're talking about a marathon here that if Donald Trump is the nominee, he's going to have to run to get anywhere near where mainstream Americans are on the issue of immigration. And I think the other thing I would point to is that even a majority of younger Republicans are in a very different place as well. And in close elections, you can't afford to lose any of your base, and particularly the next generation. And I think that's the real risk for the Republican Party right now, is that their front runners are staking out a position that's very different from even their own younger voters, and that's going to prove to be a real problem.
Robert P. Jones is CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. You can follow their essential work at publicreligion.org. We'll take another break now, but there are more State of Belief highlights on the way. What moves a congregation to provide sanctuary to an undocumented immigrant? The answer may go a long way toward explaining why cities across this nation are risking federal funding and more to follow a path of conscience on this contentious issue. And we'll get some thoughts on this week in national politics from Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. If you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. With reports of sudden surges in ICE enforcement action and widespread confusion about what's happening to immigration policy in this country, we wanted to revisit a couple of faith voices working at the forefront of the undocumented immigrant issue. In June of 2014, Welton Gaddy spoke with Reverend Allison Harrington, the pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona, which at the time was providing sanctuary to one individual. You'll also hear an excerpt of a 2013 interview with the Reverend Donna Scopper, whose congregation in New York City has likewise engaged in sanctuary ministry.
Joining me right now is a woman who is every bit as invested in the immigration issue as the loudest of the anti-immigrant voices. But her work is infused with a scriptural context that's missing from the rhetoric of the kick 'em all out crowd. The Reverend Allison Harrington is pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church. I'm very happy to have her with us on State of Belief Radio. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much.
If you would please start by talking briefly about the sanctuary movement.
The sanctuary movement was a predominantly faith-based movement arising out of the great humanitarian crisis we found ourselves in during the 1980s, when thousands of people were flooding across our border, fleeing the civil wars in places like El Salvador and Guatemala, places in Central America. They were flooding over our borders seeking asylum. And when the U.S. government wasn't offering asylum and instead was deporting them back to death squads, the church stepped up and offered them sanctuary, offered them hospitality within the walls of their churches, but also within their homes and within their hearts, and provided a safe place for them until that time in which they could have an asylum status within the United States.
How did your congregation get involved in this?
Back in the 80s, we were witnesses of people kind of showing up at the church, showing up in our community that were migrating for very different reasons than the migration that is typically seen here in the borderlands, which is more kind of economic, moving back and forth between the United States and Mexico. And these were certainly folks that were from further away and were coming for different reasons. And so my church began to respond to that in the only way that it knew how, and began to welcome them into their church families.
Talk about the case of a man named Daniel.
Daniel is a man in our community. He's not a stranger to us. He's a neighbor. He's someone who's well-known to his community, to his own church family. And he came to us, his lawyer and him came to us about 3 weeks ago now and asked for sanctuary. He had a final order of deportation on him, which meant that on May 14th, they could do what they often do, is they often come into people's homes, and this is Border Patrol or immigration, will come into people's homes and break down the doors and in a very violent way with guns, and will apprehend a person and tear them away from their family and then deport them. And so he had come to us to say, could I have sanctuary here at your church? And we felt that he was a very compelling case. He is a wonderful man who's lived here for 14 years, has paid federal and state taxes. He has a U.S.-born son, leader of his church, and we knew that his case was one that was very compelling and one that was very representative of the people that President Obama has said should not be a priority for deportation. So since May 13th, he has been living here at the church in sanctuary.
So why was it important for Southside to take that step? Was there a lot of debate about it, or were they simply ready to do it? And if so, why?
Well, I think the reason we've been center in a lot of these immigration issues, both back in the 80s as a founding church of the sanctuary movement, and now today during this fight for immigration reform and for migrant rights, we've been the center of these debates because of who we are as Christians and where we are as a mm-hmm. congregation. 60 miles from the border puts us right smack dab in the middle of an enormous amount of human need. And also, you know, we believe in Christ, and we believe that to be a disciple of Christ is to care for the stranger, to love our neighbor, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. And so definitely there was discussion, but we felt that though there may be risks, this was what we were being called to do as a congregation.
Well, are there legal risks? And if they are, what are the legal risks involved in this?
Well, one thing that I've discovered through this process is law is kind of like scripture. It's kind of up to everyone's interpretation. So there are some lawyers who will say, concealing Daniel, and so you can't be guilty of harboring. There's others that say, oh, no, definitely you could be guilty of harboring. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here we say, better in trouble with the law than in trouble with the Lord. And we really feel strongly called to provide sanctuary for this man. And it's been hard in a lot of ways to see this family suffer and to watch them as they anxiously wait for news from Washington, D.C. But there's also a lot of joy in it because they're such a lovely family who love each other so much and whose faith in the Lord is absolutely fundamental to their life. As a family.
How many people can you help like this?
We had tens of thousands of people who came through this church in the 1980s. It was a very different context and a different historical moment. We're not sure how many we can help, but, you know, every day living in the southern Arizona region, every day I'm afraid we're not doing enough because we are seeing over and over again people disappeared from our communities that we don't hear from again for months and months later when they turn up in a detention center in Louisiana or they're back over the border. And I always feel like we're not doing enough. And so I'm grateful that we've had the opportunity to at least stand alongside this one family.
As you look at the future, what is the ultimate resolution of these kinds of cases that you have as your goal?
President Obama has said that we shouldn't be in the business of tearing apart families. And I think that's an important thing to not be in the business of, tearing apart families. And there's been a lot of policies that have been passed and acknowledged by the Obama administration that says if folks have U.S. citizen children, they shouldn't be deported. And so I think moving forward, I'm hopeful that cases like Daniel's will be closed. I'm also hoping for a humane immigration reform that will have as one of its foundational principles unity of the family and reunification of family, I think is really important. You know, I've been thinking a lot about our faith and what compels us to do this. And a lot of times we do use the guidepost of welcoming the stranger mm-hmm. and knowing that when we welcome the stranger, we welcome Christ. And I think that that was important for the sanctuary movement because those were strangers. But now we're seeing people who are not our strangers. They're our community members. And so I think that there are other scripture passages that should be kind of a beacon for us. You know, the scripture passages to care for the widow and the orphan. Well, I think we need to act sooner. And I think we need to love our neighbors and mm-hmm. try to act to prevent the creation of widows and orphans through our broken immigration system. So really looking at how do we hold up the preciousness of the family as something that should not be violated by broken immigration laws. I think that's an important role that the church has within this particular historical moment.
How optimistic are you that there is a way forward considering Congress's seeming inability to act?
Well, I'm a Christian, so that means I'm a person of hope and faith.
Yes.
More than anything else. And so it's a hard historical moment because it really feels that our representatives in Congress are playing politics with people's families. And they're more concerned about politics and about re-election and about the future of their party than they are about the future of children in the United States. You know, children whose parents are being taken from that. So here's my hope is. My hope is in the church. My hope is in communities of faith. And I think back to moments in our history like the Civil Rights Movement when, you know, the U.S. government was hesitant to make any fundamental changes, but it was because of the persistent faith and the power of the church that they had to yield to the voice of morality.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hopeful for that again. I'm hopeful that other churches will see this as a time in which we can speak up. And it can be overwhelming when we think about 1,100 people a day being deported. That can be an overwhelming number, and a church can feel like, well, what are we going to do about that? And you can think about all the politics and all the complicatedness of our immigration laws. But then you can look a father in his eyes, and suddenly it does not seem like a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
To say, we're not going to let you be taken away from your 13-year-old son, Carlos. That's an easy thing to do. But you have to kind of look in those eyes and be engaged in that community. And so I really have a lot of hope that the church, that faith communities, that synagogues, that mosques will begin to do that. And then our elected representatives, those folks we pray for every Sunday,
mm-hmm.
that they will have no choice but to have a conversion.
Yeah. Allison, what action are you calling for on the groundswellmovement.org?
Thank you. People can go to groundswell-movement.org, and they can sign a petition asking the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson to close Daniel's case.
Mm-hmm. How can our listeners keep in touch with what you're doing, your work at the local or national level?
We will have updates on our website, and that's southsidepresbyterian.org.
The Reverend Allison Harrington is pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. I really do appreciate you sharing the story with us on State of Belief Radio yourself, and I hope we can talk again.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
When I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was naked, you gave me clothes. When I was the stranger, you let me in.
Despite a lot of noisy news headlines concerning Washington, the Senate has continued to work on comprehensive immigration reform. As they plow through hundreds of amendments, faith leaders from across the spectrum have been urging legislators to consider important moral aspects of the issue. And a voice with particular credibility on immigration issues is that of the Reverend Donna Scopper, the longtime senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City, and I am so happy to be able to welcome her back to State of Belief Radio. Reverend Scopper, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
I know that you personally and the Judson community have long been involved in social justice work around immigration issues. So would you start by talking about that history in that church?
It all began when we met some people who were experiencing what could only be called oppression from our own government. We met a man who has 4 children and who had served a sentence of 11 years for being involved in a drug-related crime in his 20s. He's now in his 40s, 100% rehabilitated, running a business, and he was on the verge of being deported, and it upset us so very much that we opened a door, mm-hmm. and we walked through that door and found out what was really happening to undocumented people. And we realized that we thought immigrants are a blessing, not a burden.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, we have educated ourselves and become friends with many people who are immigrants, and we want to welcome them.
Yeah.
We don't want to control them.
Reverend Scopper, you last month wrote a moving article for the Huffington Post that was headlined, "Comprehensive Immigration Reform is Refusing Blessings." Please talk about this idea of immigrants as a blessing.
Well, I mean, first of all, immigrants are the economic engine. There's tons of studies showing that if we were to send away all 11 million people who are undocumented today, which we're not going to do, that the gross national product would take a real hit. Secondly, immigrants are a blessing because they make us more colorful and more interesting, and they realize the American dream of our being all mixed up as a people. Mm-hmm. And third, I think they bring us to a place beyond our own fear about what it means to be an American. I cite in particular one statistic. So many people think that immigrants are criminals or they're dangerous or they're just going to bring us down. The facts are that they bring us up culturally and economically. But we just read a study that really profoundly affected me about the crime question. Mm-hmm. And it shows that of the 360 million people in the United States, citizens right now, 18% of them have criminal records. The population in the undocumented is a smaller percentage as best we can know. So immigrants aren't even more criminal than the American general population. So when we can live beyond our hate and our prejudices and our fears that somebody's trying to get us and see the facts, we come to a profound sense of what a blessing immigrants are to us and can be even more if we stop harassing them.
You know, it is so frustrating to see parts of the true spirit of comprehensive immigration reform, whether it's same-gender family reunification or other so-called controversial aspects, get pushed to the margins when senators repeatedly say that those issues would stall the bill. why is it that there seems to be this commitment to ensure that we only will focus on fairness for some?
Even leading with the notion of border control, immigration from Mexico has all but stopped because of the recession. And we are still going to go spend a lot of money controlling that border. It's short-sighted. It's the worst part of the American people, the part that's scared of our own power to do good. And it helps the haters. I love what Chris Quinn says. He says, you know, love, love, hate, hate. Mm. And unfortunately, we've had to learn to hate hate in this movement because there's a lot of hate out there against immigrants. And it's unwise, unfounded, and it's certainly not Christian.
Donna, with whom are you working in partnership on the work you're doing in immigration reform? And I want – that's part of the question. The second part of it is – how can State of Belief listeners get involved in your work if they wish?
Well, if you come to judson.org, our website, we can direct you to a number of organizations. We're also very involved with the New York City Immigration Coalition, which is doing bang-up work on taking this kind of mean, short-sighted bill and trying to open it up. For example, on whether GLBTQ families would be covered. Mm-hmm. So the New York Immigration Coalition is a great partner. We have about 60 congregations that are involved with us, Riverside, St. Peter's, Gustavus Adolphus, a coalition of congregations here in New York City. And any one of them can lead you to how to help with the accompaniment program. We're proud to say of our 69 that we've accompanied here that only 7 got deported. That means we've kept 62 families together.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's changed us, and it's made us have a lot of fervor for having a welcoming policy.
Yeah. It's remarkable work. I know you get tired, and so I have to ask, where do you see the signs of hope that get you up in the morning and going?
Oh, well, I certainly see them in the enormous courage of the immigrants with whom we work. I see them in, you know, the people who take care of our elderly, take care of our children, pick our strawberries, pick our lettuce, wash our dishes. For some reason, even people who are undocumented and who are being scorned seem to find a way to be hopeful and to understand that life has great meaning, even though their day-to-day existence is not as great as it could be.
Yeah.
I take great inspiration in people like Fatimatu and her daughters, in Ravi Raghbir, who is the executive director of our organization. Ravi could be deported any minute, and we are fighting to keep him here. And the more we fight to keep him here, the more he leads us to meet other people. So, you know, my answer to you from me is that I really believe God meant it when God said we're supposed to love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not that impressed with borders. I know that in certain ways they're necessary. I'm not naive. But, boy, they're getting a lot of protection that they don't need, and children and women and families and farmers, apple pickers, aren't getting the protection they need.
The Reverend Donna Scopper is senior pastor at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. She is a longtime social justice activist. She is a leading religious voice for faith and fairness as we rethink our nation's immigration policies. Donna, thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio, and please keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all your listeners for caring.
Time for one more break, and then some thoughts on American politics today from Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. There's too much happening every day right now for us to get away with a purely backward-looking highlight show. Thankfully, Interfaith Alliance president Rabbi Jack Moline agreed to be with us today to share some of his thoughts.
There are at least two different ways to think about faith consciousness in our time. One is to focus on the descriptions and prescriptions that address personal behavior. What does it mean to be a moral person, a good person, a faithful person? The other is to consider what it means to create the kind of society that is a reflection of the values our sacred literature recommends. What does it mean to have a moral society, a good society, a faithful society? I offer you this challenge as you look at what is becoming of America in the early days of this new presidency. From the beginning of President Trump's candidacy, we have followed the sparkly objects that have captured so much attention: name-calling, exaggerations and fabrications, bad language and worse behavior, denigration of half the species, bromances, and who knows what else. Even the president's supporters acknowledge his behavioral issues, though many are not too public about it for fear of an early morning tweet. It dawned on me as I watched his one and only post-election pre-inaugural press conference that my attention has been diverted as well. Faced with an opportunity to ask him about the serious issues facing his administration, what was the focus of the first journalist's questions? We were offered the chance to watch the parrying over the alleged videotape that the Russians do or do not have, a series of what-ifs and oh-no-you-don'ts, culminating with a public chastisement of a news network for reporting what may or may not have been news. The conversation slipped away, and soon a Trump attorney was skimming over the details of a stack of briefing books on the structuring of Trump's businesses. But the questions that need to be asked if we are to have the kind of society we're meant to be went unasked and therefore unanswered. Here are some of them. What are the details of the replace half of the equation regarding the Affordable Care Act? Will 20 million people who rely on it be protected in the interim, while you make good on your promise to repeal it within your first 100 days of office? Will your Secretary of Education honor the constitutional separation between religion and government? Betsy DeVos has advocated otherwise. Will you direct her to uphold the Constitution, or will your approach be more laissez-faire? Can non-Christians count on the full protection of the Department of Justice if the federal hate crime statute is violated? Do the constitutional guarantees of equal treatment under the law apply to gays, lesbians, and transgender people, or may personal convictions of civil servants and business owners exempt them from providing what heterosexuals are entitled to? Who will care for the poor while the middle class is being shored up and fully employed? Will you send a message to the Republican House and Senate about their responsibility to ensure that Americans do not go hungry and homeless while taxes are being cut and regulations are being loosed? Will women be able to access health care to which they've become entitled and accustomed under the law? Have you concluded that we should follow the overwhelming scientific evidence on climate change, on vaccinations, on drug testing, and the like? Or is there a standard that you will follow that you're willing to identify? How should we evaluate whether the people chosen to lead our diplomatic presence in other countries are adherents of your foreign policy or pursuers of their own politics? And just exactly what is your foreign policy? Journalists most certainly need the support and defense of their First Amendment rights just as much as we do in the faith community. But if some of them, or all of them, continue to follow the lure of distraction when critical matters are before us, then we must be the ones to take up the task. So I'm issuing a plea to faith communities with a commitment to social conscience. Do not allow yourselves to be distracted from your mission. We can all agree that in matters of personal conduct, the president, like all of us, falls short of the ideal. Perhaps we're justified to expect that the leader of our nation will set an example of comportment to which we can all aspire. But if he does not, we will not persuade him to behave otherwise. However, the mandates of our faiths and our philosophies are to act with compassion and integrity on behalf of the disadvantaged. It would be a betrayal of our values and our commitments to relinquish the prophetic voice in favor of the prurient. So I encourage you to consider the vulnerable in our society, the necessary attention to national interests, the impact of honest science and facts and evidence, and to raise your voice where it can make a difference, especially in mobilizing your community of faith or philosophy on their behalf in government and on the ground, rather than to make you feel as if you have discovered that the emperor's new clothes are not all they're cracked up to be. Besides, we all know that anyway. That's my perspective on State of Belief Radio.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's special Best of State of Belief show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, we want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, we urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter, or direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. I'm State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.